This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. As Gianni Infantino tries to get an uninterested audience to yell FIFA, 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 and as the world's press converge on Doha for the draw tomorrow, we do the most important thing and work out the possible group of death. Meanwhile, the CEO of the tournament takes umbrage with Gareth Southgate and the World Cup ball is unveiled. In Barcelona, 90,000 people turn up to watch the women's El Clasico Champions League quarterfinal, and the greatest league in the world is back, much to preview in the Premier League, a title race, a race for the top four, and a battle to survive. You've come up with some excellent merchandise ideas and some very niche ones, and you've asked some questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, welcome.
Yo,
back. Paul McInnes, hello.
Good morning.
Barry Glendening, welcome.
Hello.
Simon says, can we have a World Cup preview? And also, what times are the games going to be played in the UK? So FIFA's confirmed the first two round of matches will kick off at 1, 4, 7 and 10 local time. So in the UK, it's pretty perfect all-day football. 10 a.m., 1 p.m., 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. So I can't boycott that because the World Cup's on at a really good time. The kickoff times of the final round of group games and knockout matches will be 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. local time. So that's 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. for the knockouts. And we know all but three qualifiers for the World Cup. So I did challenge you about half an hour ago to come up with what you think it would be the group of death. And I don't know if you've all done it, but let's go to Paul first. What have you selected for a group of death?
Yeah, I think to be fair, I found it pretty easy just because I didn't think about it for very long. And I looked at the list and I saw Brazil in pot one, Germany in pot two, Senegal in pot three. And then I thought about a wild card and maybe go Canada in pot four, but I just went for Ghana. So, you know, I think that's a pretty competitive group. All in all.
Yeah. Barry, is yours similar or?
Almost identical, but not quite. I've gone for Argentina, Germany, Senegal and Wales, who haven't qualified yet.
That's true. What about you, Jordan?
Yeah, mine was similar as well. Actually, I've gone Argentina. I went USA. I think they're going to be a weird one. Wales and... I think Ghana went with as well, written down. Yeah.
Weird. You can't have that because Ghana and Wales be in the same pot.
Of course, yeah. Sorry.
Senegal.
I like them. They're my new favourite team because I was there on holiday recently. But yeah, I went for a weird group rather than a hard group.
Yeah, well, that isn't what the rule is for the group of death. I mean, I watched the USA lose to Costa Rica overnight. And I'd say, I've written in what is the possible best case scenario for... You know, England. I've taken USA from pot two, and I promise that isn't. I don't think an anti-American bias when I look at the teams in pot two. I think you could get USA, Iran, and then whoever wins out of Costa Rica and New Zealand. And I mean, England have failed to get out of groups like that in the past. So, and then for the for Scotland and Wales, who are in pot four, which might be a bit harsh that they're in pot four, but they have to be because I think they're not necessarily in it yet, and it's them or Ukraine. You could swap out, you could just put Qatar in from pot one, who I think, Paul, are the weakest team in pot one when you look at Brazil, Belgium, France, Argentina, England, Spain and Portugal.
It certainly would be lacking in international pedigree, no? The Qataris. But they did this thing where to give them a bit of experience, because everything has been done to make the Qataris feel welcome and included in the football family. They let them play loads of friendlies against European teams and let them play in the CONCACAF Gold Cup as well as a guest team. They got to the semis of the Gold Cup where they got beat, had a narrow defeat against the USA. That was last year. And then they played two friendlies this year. Drew with Slovenia on Tuesday, beat Bulgaria 2-1. But, these are sort of lower mid-ranking European teams. Not a bad level to be at. I mean, I don't think it put you pot one, but maybe no pushovers and they're going to have home advantage, aren't they? They're going to be accustomed to those air-conditioned stadia.
They are. What's everybody made? I was just talking to producer Joel before the pod. I've already seen, you know, because obviously a lot of people have gone to Doha. A lot of journalists are there. A lot of people, you know, taking photos going, look, I'm having a nice time. Isn't it nice here? Almost like immediately doing sort of what I think the Qataris would like journalists to do and say, well, look, I can only comment on what I can see, which is a pint of lager and some football on the telly. And it almost feels to me that, you know, the same way with the Russia World Cup, we, as soon as the football started, we stopped talking about anything else. That we, or a lot of people, and maybe we will be guilty of this to some level, will start doing exactly the same, Baz.
Yeah, I saw Miguel Delaney. He's off to Doha, and he was explaining, you know, just to be clear to all the Newcastle, Manchester City and PSG fans who regularly get very exercised about his phrase into geopolitics, that, you know, journalists are going to cover the World Cup, they're going to cover the draw, and it's right that they should, because it's a lot of the abuse he ships is from people who think that journalists should boycott the World Cup, and I don't think they should. They should go and shine a light in the dark corners and report on what's going on. But there is a chance that they won't do that, or they won't be allowed to do that, because all that stuff will be hidden from them. But certainly I know groups like Amnesty International don't want journalists or teams to boycott the World Cup. They want them to go. And there's this misconception that it's a big jolly, which is not the case. Obviously, it's a nice, you know, going to a World Cup is a pleasant thing to do, but it is work, and it's hard work for journalists who are out there. So, but yeah, there is a possibility that all the shit stuff that's going on there will be ignored.
Yeah, just to kind of add to that, I think that the optics, I reckon, from football fans that think that journalists are, you know, hypocrites in that we condemn what's happening in places like Qatar, but when they see people tweeting and posting on Instagram and out there covering the football, it's like, well, hang on a minute, you guys are the ones that were saying they shouldn't have it, rare tear tear. I get the optics of how that looks on the outside. I must admit, I personally, I don't want to speak for all journalists, but I am a little bit conflicted. I mean, I want to go and I hope to be covering this World Cup, but I still have to square the circle, horrible business jargon there, but of on one side wanting to cover a massive sporting tournament as a sports broadcaster, but equally being uncomfortable that I'm there. And that's just me. I don't want to talk for other journalists, but I do get why, you know, some fans would say, you know, you guys are all hypocrites. You guys say you're going under the pretense that it's a journalist's job to be there and ask questions. But I think, as Barry alluded to there, how much of that investigative journalism is going to be happening out there, especially if England start doing well and the home nations start doing well. I'm not so sure that will... Maybe I'm doing my colleagues a bit of a disservice there, but I get why the optics, from a fan's point of view, look very hypocritical.
I do wonder if the same people who think football journalists shouldn't go and cover the World Cup also think that war correspondents should boycott the invasion of Ukraine, because... I don't see any difference, and it would be preposterous for journalists or news organizations not to cover the war in Ukraine or other conflicts. It would be quite ludicrous.
I guess the counter, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, Barry, that the public would say is that there is a bigger duty for journalists to be covering a war that's affecting, if you like, mass populations / the world. There's no duty to cover a World Cup. I'm just saying that's what I think would be the response to that. Nobody has to go to a football tournament.
You could say that, you know, in terms of the World Cup, you should only send people like Tariq Panjo or Sean Ingle to cover the, you know, the political side of it, and not send people to cover the football, the actual enjoyable bit of it. Whereas war correspondents are going to cover the important stuff that needs to be, you know, relayed and to the public at large.
I mean, can you do both? I mean, that's, I mean, this is a question, you know, that we need to have as a pod, right? We want to cover the football because that's what we do, but we also don't want to, I think, you know, you could say with Russia, we basically just, when the World Cup started, we went, you know, we stopped talking about, you know, any criticism of the Putin regime being shut down. We stopped talking about anything that wasn't to do with just the football when we covered the World Cup in 2018. We need to do that in a different way, but people obviously want to listen to us talking about football.
And how do you do that? You know, how do you do that beyond sort of repeating these things are the case in Qatar? You know, homosexuality is, you know, is illegal. You know, if you, do you repeat that every day before the podcast? Because it's going to be unlikely, particularly since, you know, the plan is to allow LGBTQ plus people to, you know, carry rainbow flags and, you know, possibly hold hands and things. I mean, it's, if anybody starts getting off with each other in public, I think that could be a incident. But if there isn't that sort of thing, if it's, if people are respectful as the Qataris ask them to be, and I'm holding up my fingers and doing inverted commas there, the Qataris are going to turn half a blind eye to it for the duration of the tournament before going back to normal. What are we going to see? I think Barry's already made that point. What are we going to see during the tournament that's going to mean, that's going to kind of be the sort of stuff that we would report on as news? I wonder, probably not that much. So then it's kind of like, are we just, you know, is it our responsibility to repeat the messages that have already been out there? And you know, maybe that is the answer.
Yeah, I genuinely don't know. Interesting comments by the Qatar 2022 CEO, Nasser Al-Khater, reacting to Gareth Southgate's concerns about Qatar. He said he needs to come here and speak to workers and understand what workers get out of being here. That included, he said, putting their children through university, building homes, which he described as the stories that nobody hears. On homosexuality being illegal, he claimed Qatar was the safest country in the Middle East, the second safest in the world, insisted people would feel safe and comfortable. What I can say to fans is we're a modest country. We have our culture. We have our norms. What we ask of them is to respect it. He said, whether you're a gay couple, whether you're a heterosexual couple, we have the same norms. We look at it in the same way. He offered to meet Southgate in Qatar on Friday when the draw was being made. Yes, Paul?
I think one of the things I thought about that answer is that, you know, it's clever because I don't think, you know, Southgate personally has been to Qatar. But Mark Bullingham, the chief executive of the FA, is a member of a UEFA working group that has been more than once to Qatar and, you know, has met with migrant workers, has spoken to Amnesty, has spoken to the BWI union, who are kind of organising, you know, an attempt to sort of improve workers' rights over there. So Bullingham is pretty clued up, and Bullingham briefed, you know, Bullingham will have briefed Southgate. Southgate will have spoken to him. Southgate will be reasonably well informed, even if his experience isn't firsthand.
I think if Southgate and the English FA are gonna come out between now and November with statements around, you know, having concerns about what's happening in this country, they've got to back it up for me now with action. They've got to do something, I think. Otherwise, you know, you've said you're not going to boycott the World Cup. You're going to be there. It's always a case of keep talking about the things that you think are wrong with the country, but then back it up with some kind of action, or almost just go play football and then go back. I don't understand what kind of coming out and calling out what's happening there on its own is achieving. Call it out and then...
What could they do?
I don't know. They could do something with the shirts, maybe. They could have some kind of initiative that supports the people that they feel are somehow being oppressed. I'm not sure, but I just think words now, if you're going to condemn a country, and arguably rightfully so, I just think doing that, keep continuously doing that and having it just as words, I just think is a bit pointless now. And if you are the people from that country, I'd be saying what, you know, what the chief executive has said, you know, come here, educate yourself about what you're saying is wrong here, or kind of shut up or don't come. Either, you know, put up or shut up sort of thing. So I think Southgate's got to be very, very careful now about continuously saying what he thinks is wrong and happening in that country without then backing up with some kind of solution.
I think it's a really good point. And you know, I've done a little bit of reporting around this and speaking to people about it. And, you know, the teams and what they're going to do in the tournament is one thing. And I think you probably will see things like T-shirts. You'll probably see the teams en masse squads going to visit migrant camps And whether all that will be official or not, I think that's the interesting thing. Will they go off-piste and do things? They've also heard rumours that they'll give workers a platform to speak through, a media opportunity that the kind of money might otherwise go to the footballers, something like that. But there's more that for me, the interesting question is not so much what happens to raise awareness during the event, because I think, as Jordan says, there's been a lot of talk about that. Awareness has been raised and a lot of statements made. It's about legacy. It's about what happens in Qatar after the World Cup has gone. And I think there's a genuine concern that there won't be that much of it. I was speaking to somebody the other day who's very involved in these sorts of things, and he was not hopeful that there is just a feeling now that they're going to get through the tournament, get to the end of it and move on. But one idea that is going around that is kind of official is to kind of create a workers' centre in Qatar that is sort of a haven for workers who, if they're not being allowed to leave their contracts, if they're not being allowed to go home, if they're not getting paid, that they can go to this centre, get access to legal advice, get access to support, which would be the centre that would be set up by the Building and Woodworkers International, BWI. And it's sort of an idea that's being pushed by the International Players Union, FIFPro. So that's one sort of concrete idea. And I think the more concrete ideas there are, the better. But it's getting late.
Did anybody see Gianni Infantino in front of a crowd trying to get them to say FIFA, FIFA, FIFA? I wouldn't open with it, Barry. Yes, when we do our live tour, we'll see if we can get the crowd to yell FIFA. It was utterly painful, Baz, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was quite toe curling. I'm not sure who the audience were, but Gianni was trying to cheerlead, and it wasn't really working for him. But he didn't seem that bothered.
No.
He was like a really bad old school garage MC trying to kind of get the crowd to, when I say baseline, you say garage. Baseline is like, hey, this is really bad. Like, let it go. You're not that guy.
He embraces the cringe though, doesn't he, Infantino?
He does.
He loves it. He's absolutely, doesn't bother him at all.
When I say FIFA, you say normalization committee. Yeah, sounds good, doesn't it? Paul says, I've listened in vain to two International Week pods and no mention of Scotland. Wales seem to have been anointed into the World Cup. Time to invoke the spirit of Keegan 96. I would love it. Baz, do you have any fit bar for us?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's understandable that we neglected Scotland because obviously they were supposed to have their playoff semi-final against Ukraine. That didn't happen. So they played a friendly against Poland, which they drew 1-1. That took them to 7 games unbeaten. And then more recently, they played Austria in Vienna. It was a really good game, actually. Scotland went 2 goals up, courtesy of Jack Hendry and John McGinn. And before they scored their 2 goals, they'd missed a few chances, and Craig Gordon in goals for Scotland had to pull off some remarkable saves to keep the Austrians out. And then Scotland conceded 2, so they ended up drawing 2-2. Could have lost 3-2. Craig Gordon with another fine save. He had a really good game. And so the upshot, I suppose, is Scotland are now 8 games unbeaten. Still not quite sure when they're going to play Ukraine or if they're going to play Ukraine, which obviously our thoughts are with Ukraine and all our sympathy should be with Ukraine. But it is a kind of difficult situation in which Scotland find themselves. Whether they will have to play Ukraine before they get a shot at Wales in the eliminator. And the big news, I suppose, in Scotland as well, is that the third Old Firm derby of the season is on Sunday at lunchtime. Celtic are 3 points clear at the top of the table. Ostensibly, they're 4 points clear because their goal difference is so vastly superior with, I think, 6 games of the season left. And, yeah, so Rangers really need... They certainly can't afford to lose that game, and ideally they need to win it. And if they did win it, it's at Ibrox. it would certainly spice things up as we approach the run in to the end of the season.
Yeah. Sounds like we should go to Ewan's Jazz Bar on Monday.
I think we should, actually. Interesting, Rangers had three players playing for Nigeria in that game, which they lost against Ghana the other night, and the crowd trouble after the game. Joe Aribo, Calvin Bassey and Leon Balogun were all there on behalf of Rangers, so hopefully they're not too traumatised by events ahead of the Old Firm game.
It could actually gee them up, couldn't it? Sort of what you need before an Old Firm game. Costa Rica 2, USA 0. I did watch it. It wasn't that exciting, but I'd completely forgotten that Keylor Navas plays in goal for Costa Rica. They can obviously still get through. They've got that game against New Zealand. New Zealand beat the Solomon Islands 5-0 in what was a bit of a mismatch. I thought Joe Bell, who played in centre mid for New Zealand, plays for Bromby, looked like quite a good player. Not heard of him before. The official ball for the 2022 FIFA World Cup has been unveiled by Adidas. It's called Al Rila, and it takes its name from the Arabic word for the journey. The ball is just the beginning. The rest of your football journey is yet to be written, reads Al Rila's caption on adidas.com, where it's on sale for $165.
Have goalkeepers started complaining about it yet?
What? $165?
$165, yeah, what's that? 90 quid? It's expensive. Get a shoot size 5. Just 15p from a garage, isn't it? According to FIFA.com, Barry, the ball, quote, travels faster in flight than any other in the tournament's history. Those goalkeepers will be complaining. Maybe it goes like warp speed, like in Star Wars. Somebody leathers it and then space just goes, boom, and it'll just be in the goal. It
goes back in time.
Its design is said to be inspired by the culture, architecture, iconic boats and flags of Qatar. So there we are. And that'll do for part one. Part two, Susie Rack will join us, and we'll talk about that record-breaking attendance at the Nou Camp for Barcelona Real Madrid in the Women's Champions League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Susie Rack, the Guardian's women's football correspondent, joins us. Hey, Susie.
Hey, guys.
So, Women's Champions League, Barcelona beat Real Madrid 5-2, comfortable in the end, although it was exciting when Real Madrid brought it back to 2-1 and there was one goal in it on aggregate. The main story is the fact that 91,553 people were there. No games had more people in it all season, including the men's Clásico. It's a new record for an attendance at a women's football match, or is it? I saw you tweeting yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's the official record for like FIFA sanctioned match, in the prior to the game being officially recognised or there being an official Women's World Cup. There were a load of unofficial Women's World Cups and Women's Euros and an unofficial Women's World Cup, which England competed in 1971, had between 110 is the lowest report and about 125,000 people at it. Obviously, like, technology wasn't advanced, so they weren't necessarily accurate. But sort of the lower estimates or guesstimates from that game are 110,000. So it's a little bit, I understand why people do it. And, oh, it looks great, the world record attendance, etc. It's slightly disrespectful to the players that were playing at that time to say it is the biggest ever attendance because, you know, a lot of work was done by people before the game was official that it is important to not like whitewash over for the sake of a snappy headline. But yeah, I mean, it's huge. It's the biggest, you know, it beats the 99 World Cup final where the US were, you know, kind of so dominant and it was on home soil and all of that and a real game changing match. And it is hugely significant. And I couldn't go because of childcare, which is just a little bit gutting from all accounts. What was most impressive was that the atmosphere was insane and that it was just absolutely rocking from start to finish, which is just not something you really see at women's games, you know, better than any World Cup match, better than any cup final in 2019 or the Euros in 2017, where you had sold out stadium and the Netherlands winning on home soil. It was the atmosphere that sold it. And there were like videos before the game of the team arriving and like the crowds just swamping the coach and chanting and singing and stuff. And there was a real party atmosphere. And if you watched it, you know, you saw at the ends that like none of the fans left either for quite a while afterwards. There was just this real good vibe there, which was is just incredible, really.
And I mean, is this a sort of unique situation? Are they doing something different in Spain to England? Or was it just is El Clasico and it's a Champions League quarterfinal, all those things together?
A bit of everything. They have done quite a lot in that, just in terms of the way they've been treating the women's team and investing in it in the past sort of like 5 to 7 years. They've really had a not totally equal approach, obviously, because they're not, you know, say paying the women's players the same as the men's, for example. But in terms of like attitude and marketing and things like that, they've really gone big on the women's team and very much just treated it as, you know, this is Barcelona. This isn't Barcelona's women's team. And for this game, every member could claim 4 free tickets. And then they were sold at a sort of, I think it was 11 to 16 euros a ticket. And that's when they sold out really quickly. And then they released a few, like a small amount, I think yesterday or day before yesterday, for slightly more, for sort of 13 to 26 euros. And they've just had a massive, like they've somehow like really garnered the existing club fan base and got them to embrace this team like their own. And obviously it helps when they're a European Championship winning team, when you've got Alexia Putellas as the golden, the Ballon d'Or winner, the UEFA Player of the Year, the FIFA Best Player of the Year. All of that helps, but it's not, you know, necessarily the key factor in building the ground. I think what they've done marketing wise, and I mean they organized trips for press to go out there and had tour, you know, kind of them going on tours of La Masia and sit down talks about what they've done with the team for the past, you know, 5 years or so and things like that ahead of this game. They really pushed for the press and the build up, and in a way that I don't think we've seen any club really do, really like take risks and be quite bold and brave about it. I think, you know, a lot of teams are a little bit too cautious sometimes.
It's quite interesting as well, is it? I mean, in England, I think you've said it, I'm not sure, that actually some women's teams prefer playing in their smaller home grounds. You know, Chelsea would rather play at King's Meadow than Stamford Bridge, for example.
I disagree with it because like some of these stadiums are so inaccessible. King's Meadow has a great atmosphere and it's rocking when it's full. You know, the idea for me now that we're not at a stage where Chelsea could start playing a couple of games or a few games a season at Stamford Bridge and get decent turnouts, I think is an unrealistic one. Previously, the argument was sort of like, oh, you're conceding your home advantage, having, you know, a few thousand people in a, or say five or 6,000 people in a Stamford Bridge is not as good as having a sold out 4,000 at King's Meadow and things like that. But I think we're past a stage where it is sort of 4,000 or 5,000, although Arsenal Wolfsburg was that the other night, but they were putting more effort into Saturday's North London derby, which was also there, but then postponed. I think we're sort of past that argument now, although I did hear Emma Hayes make it the other day still, which I kind of find slightly disappointing because, you know, a big factor for me is how accessible the clubs are and also the how it looks when you put a club on your best pitch in your main stage with, you know, the best ground. You know, like a lot of the Arsenal players who have played at the Emirates recently saying it's really nice to play on a good pitch because Boreham Wood has been not great of late. And just the respect that sort of goes with that, I think, is important. And it sends a message in and of itself. Just putting your team there, putting your team on your biggest stage sends quite a big message. So for me, you know, I think it's sort of time to think bigger generally for particularly the biggest of clubs. And, you know, the big stadiums, the Spurs stadium, for example, has a pull in and of itself. You know, people want to go to that stadium because it's a great stadium and you've not necessarily experienced before, and you can, you know, get an affordable ticket to go is a big draw. And if it gets more eyes on the game, then it's worth it.
Did onto the game itself, did you think when Real Madrid went 2-1 up, and that was Claudio Zanozza's, I mean, it was a beautiful chip, wasn't it? It was an absolutely brilliant goal. Did any part of you think, Rail could win this or not?
It was wonderful. I mean, I never thought they could win it. I just in those circumstances, there was no way Barcelona were ever going to let that game be lost. And they've just got too much quality, much more in their legs across 90 minutes than Real were ever going to have. Yeah, it spoke to the first leg a little bit in that, you know, Real Madrid took the lead and then Barcelona came back and, you know, sort of comfortably beat them. It is great that Real Madrid even scored. You know, Barcelona have conceded so few goals across the course of this season. You know, they thrashed Arsenal 4-0 and 4-1. They're really, like, swaggering. And they sort of didn't have quite as much of that swagger last night. You know, Real Madrid have sort of found a way of not nullifying them, because obviously they still smashed them 5-2, but inhibiting them for periods of the game, which is sort of a tiny little glimpse of a blueprint of how you might be able to possibly beat this, like, all-conquering, like, real satisfying to watch team.
Can any of the other sides that are, you know, still in it, so PSG went through, you know, that goal in extra time, took them past Bayern Munich. Then you've got Wolfsburg, Arsenal at one apiece, Juve 2-1 up going to Lyon. Can any of those sides look at what Real Madrid did and think there is a way to get past Barcelona? And if they can, which of those teams still in the tournament could do that?
They're all better than Real Madrid. So any of them, in theory, can take that blueprint and run with it. PSG were slightly lucky yesterday in that, like, Bayern Munich had so many players out with a COVID outbreak and a bunch of long-term injuries and then a suspension as well, that meant that they had four subs on their bench and two of them were goalkeepers. So, like, PSG scraping through that game despite Bayern having basically nothing on the bench is probably, like, yeah, expected. That was a pretty even matchup. Arsenal Wolfsburg could go either way. I mean, it totally depends on, I suppose, which Arsenal show up, to be very, very cliched about it, because they are very much a team lacking consistency across this season so far. For Juventus Lyon, what's exciting about that is Juventus are ahead in the tie, but Lyon you know, kind of seven-time winners of this competition and arguably probably the team that would be, despite in a sort of little period of transition, the ones with the most confidence going up against Barcelona, because they have done this so many times before in this competition. You know, they are so experienced. They beat Barcelona 4-1, I want to say, in Barcelona's first Champions League final a few years back. You know, that was when Barcelona was still an evolving side, but they know how to win this tournament, whereas a lot of the other teams are still newbies at it. Wolfsburg, maybe. German teams in the Champions League are really difficult to play, as most English teams have found out at various points, and Arsenal may do tonight.
Going back to ticket sales, the remaining tickets for the final of the Women's Euros sold out in an hour, with 100 days to go before England kick off against Austria in Old Trafford. More than 350,000 of the 700,000 tickets available had been sold during pre-sales and a public ballot window, which means that the tournament's already passed the record of just over 240,000 tickets sold for Euro 2017. So that is great, isn't it? I mean, this Euro should be brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. It's really good. The only thing that I sort of look at and get slightly, I told you so about, is the choice of the stadiums for the games. I mean, we've got, you know, we've already sold almost 100,000 more tickets, or more than that, in fact, than the last edition of this competition. And you've got Brentford as one of the stadiums that holds 17,000. Man City's Academy Stadium holds 7,000. You've got Stadium MK, Rotherham, Leeds Sports Village, capacity 12,000. You can't get there without driving, basically, or unless you get an hour-long bus and then do a 15-minute walk along a canal. Like, they're not the most inspiring choices of stadiums. I get that it's some of the smaller teams play in there, and the ones that are selling out are the England fixtures. But being, you know, the England fixtures are at Brighton, great stadium, to be fair, Southampton, and, you know, obviously the opener at Old Trafford. But you just feel like, why haven't we got a big London Stadium other than Wembley? Why haven't we got Anfield? You know, why haven't we got some of the big name stadiums? Why haven't we got Elland Road? You know, like there's obviously some great stadiums that are big pools in and of themselves. And I just think it lacks a little bit of ambition. And the problem is like the UEFA and the FA have sort of freely admitted that when they bid for this, well, or when the FA, when they bid for this tournament and when they were sort of putting together the proposal, they were sort of not necessarily expecting women's football to explode in the way it has and to grow in the way it has. And they've almost been sort of, they're now basically building for a tournament and the scale of a tournament that is very different to what they were bidding for and what they thought it would be. And for me, that was very, very naive in that, like, at the time, as soon as they had started to announce some of those stadiums, we were like, hang on, you know, this is a growing game. Aren't you going to be caught out here? They upgraded. Old Trafford wasn't initially on the list. And it was, I can't remember which stadium was hosting the opener, but it was not Old Trafford. And that was one of the changes they made when they started to panic about the fact that they hadn't got any sort of the really, really big stadiums beyond Wembley. And they've, you know, they've basically virtually, if not already, sold out Old Trafford as well. So for me, that's the only disappointment, is that they weren't slightly more ambitious from the start. That said, you know, if you get 7,000 at the City Academy Stadium watching some, you know, small game of two teams that people don't know much about, then that's a good thing. But I think you'd probably would have got a few more at the Etihad and a bit more of a sort of, I suppose what you're searching for is the London 2012 vibe to a tournament where people just want to go to anything, you know, where I went to London 2012, I went to the Paralympics. I've never watched Paralympic sport before. I absolutely loved it. I had a blast and I bought tickets because I wanted to be involved in the tournament as a whole and that vibe. And it was great. And you sort of want people to want to go to an Austria v whatever, or, you know, one of those games where, they're not as necessarily attractive, but one of the ways you do that is by putting in a stadium that people sort of, yeah, oh, I've never been there, or I might want to go there and I want to be a part of this vibe, and we're going to make it a great party atmosphere. And yeah, Lee Sports Village, not a nice place to get to. Great little stadium once you're there.
The popularity of this tournament, though, Susie, it's basically your fault and the fault of other women's football journalists and broadcasters, because you just insist on ramming the game down our throats.
I know, right? Those 91,000 in Barcelona just, like, have basically been worn down.
Erosion. That's what exactly. It is. Can you tell us about the new Guardian Women's Football newsletter that has been launched, what it's called, what it is, how you can get it, and all those things?
Yeah, moving the goalposts. It's great because it's, you know, we've had a lot of women's football coverage at The Guardian for a long time. And one of the things that I've always had a problem with is the fact that, like, finding it all in one place and sort of being aware of it always being quite hard, even though I write most of it. Like, there's so much stuff from some of the other writers that I just don't even see or totally miss. So it's quite good to have, like, a roundup landing in your inbox every week that rounds up everything that's going on. The writers doing it are brilliant. Sophie Downey from Girls on the Ball, who's been working in the game for like 10 years, has covered over 800 women's games. And Julia Bellos, who is a Brazilian women's football journalist, again, like, huge knowledge in the international game. And then we've got, like, possibly some big names doing, I say possibly, definitely, some big names doing some guest ones, like, in the coming months, you know, everyone from, like, Ada Hegerberg to Hope Solo to Lotta Vobbenmooy, like, all signed up to do the odd one here and there. And, you know, what's nice about that is we're sort of giving them a bit of a free rein to write about whatever they want to write about in it and take up whatever issue they want to take up, which is kind of cool. And yeah, you can sign up at guardian.com/football/series/moving the goalposts.
Okay, well, we will tweet it out.
I had the first installment rammed down my throat yesterday when I opened my inbox. It was there waiting for me, and it's very good.
Oh, that's really good, because it means that it you're like, our enforced subscription worked.
Yes.
Cheers, Susie. Thanks for forcing yourself on us for this bit of the pod. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, guys.
Susie Rack there, Guardian Women's Football correspondent. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League weekend.
Hello, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland here. I now have my own US politics podcast, which is, helpfully, called Politics Weekly America. So if you want to hear my interviews with politicians like Hillary Clinton or expert analysis from Guardian journalists and the latest news from Washington, D.C. and beyond, you should subscribe. To do that, just type Politics Weekly America into Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there every Friday.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League returns between 8 and 11 games to go, depending on whether you're Burnley or not. At one point, separates Manchester City and Liverpool. Liverpool host Watford. Burnley play Manchester City. And that is before Manchester City-Liverpool next weekend, which... You know, I mean, occasionally some people overstate, you know, the excitement of the Premier League, but building towards that game is going to be so exciting. And those two games as well, really big at the bottom as well as at the top, Jordan.
Yeah, they are. And just going back to your initial point there about the build-up to the City-Liverpool game, I think what's going to make it even more exciting is the fact that I foresee Liverpool winning their game against Watford. I'm not convinced Manchester City beat Burnley. So I think Liverpool might have a couple of points lead going into that game. So, yeah, I mean, top of the table. We know what's happening there. The bottom, I'm actually a bit more interested. I'm boring anyway, but I'm a bit more intrigued by the bottom of the table and, you know, the Burnley-Watford thing. Everyone seems to have written Watford off, saying, oh, they can't do it, they can't do it. I've got a feeling Watford are going to stay up, but I think Roy Hodgson will work it out down there. So I think despite losing to Liverpool this weekend, I'm keeping an eye on Watford.
The expense of who? Do you think Everton? Because really, Everton, Leeds or Brentford, you know?
I think Everton are going to go. I think Norwich are pretty much gone. And then I think it will be Brentford or Leeds. And I fear Brentford may. I know they got a big win last week.
You're saving Burnley as well as staying up?
Yeah, I think Burnley will stay up as well.
Wow.
Yeah. It's my bottom three.
That'd be extraordinary. Paul, do you subscribe to any of those? I tend to think those three that are there are there.
I don't think I do, no. I take the point about Watford, you know, because of Roy, really, that he's got the experience and he's pulled off more than one miracle in the past. But they've played two more games in Everton. Everton's run has been poor. I'm not sure that Frank Lampard is the man, but at the same time, have they ever been relegated in their history?
I don't think so.
I think, I don't know. I just think these sort of things are, I think these things are just going to sort of, I see it, I don't think it is a particularly exciting relegation race now. I think it's the three in the bottom three who are going down. I think Brentford and Leeds in the last couple of weeks have done enough to keep themselves up.
Everton, did they go down in 53? Am I making that up?
Yeah, they went down in the 50s. They haven't been relegated in my lifetime, and they haven't been relegated since the invention of football in 1992.
Right. Which one of those came first, mate? Is it implied there that you were born after the inception of the Premier League?
Oh, I very much was not. I was born 19 years before the invention of football.
Do either of you, Barry, I'd be surprised if City slipped up against Burnley. I can sort of see, I think Burnley's got that image that it's a tough place to go, and actually the stats sort of belie that slightly, yeah.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if City slipped up in that game. I'd be more inclined to think Brentford could get a result at Chelsea. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Leeds beat Southampton, but then, you know, Southampton are a very up and down team. You're never quite sure what you're going to get with them. They travel to Leeds, who are just had two remarkable wins in their past two games. Yeah, I think Leeds and Brentford will stay up. I think it's Norwich, Watford, Burnley, Everton, three of those four, and I couldn't really say who.
So you're saying that Norwich could escape at the expense of Everton? Is that what you're saying, Barry?
Yeah.
Yes!
Well done. The race for fourth place is quite exciting because Manchester United host Leicester on Saturday, so then they can put a bit of pressure on Spurs and Arsenal. Spurs then play Newcastle on Sunday. They can put a bit of pressure on Arsenal. Arsenal are in the box seat, 3 points clear of Spurs and have a game in hand. With your Arsenal hat on, Jordan, I mean, it looks very positive, doesn't it? There's still that North London derby to come, and they haven't put that game in, have they?
I think yesterday it was announced, I might have to double joke this as I'm talking here, but I think it's the second to last game of the season. I think 12th of May, if I'm not making stuff up here, as I'm going to continue to talk and correct myself as I talk, but I think they've put it in as the second to last game of the season. But either way, I mean, I think the further away that fixture is for Arsenal and Arsenal fans, the better. I think it suits Arsenal to have that game pushed back as far away as possible. I think if you're a Spurs fan, you want to play Arsenal at Spurs as soon as possible to really, you know, try and you know, break their winning run, try and start a collapse ASAP. The fear, I guess, if you're a Spurs fan is that, you know, it could well be over by the second to last game of the season. So I think Arsenal in the box seat is theirs to lose. I think only a collapse from Arsenal from here on in would see them not finish fourth. They have some tough games. But what I find interesting is that everyone's saying, oh, Arsenal have the hardest run in, which A, I don't know what a hard run in is these days. What is a hard run in? Like, that's weird for me. But also people are forgetting that of the three contenders, Arsenal, United and Spurs, Arsenal are in the best form. So Arsenal are the best placed to win those supposedly tough games as well. So
hang on. I mean, isn't a tougher run in just playing better teams, or am I being sort of naive?
At this point of the season, is Burnley a hard game, or is, you know, they're fine for their lives? Is playing a team trying to get, do you know what I mean? What's a hard game now? Apart from Southampton, who are playing for nothing, or Norwich, every game in theory is hard. sorry, mate. every game is a hard game. So I never understand when people say they've got a really hard run in. It's like, okay, I don't get what that means. But anyway, Arsenal to lose.
Premier League clubs considering reintroducing 5 substitutions per game, and they voted against the introduction on 3 occasions in the past 2 years. That means England's top flight is the only top-level league in Europe where 3 changes remains the maximum permitted. 14 of the 20 teams need to agree for it to be implemented before next season. James has been in touch to say, not a question, I thought you might like to know that Roberto Baggio collects wooden ducks. He's got thousands of them. That's the sort of information I like people to get in touch with. There is a video, which I'll retweet, of Roberto Baggio showing someone around his house with a collection of mallards and other ducks, drakes. They're the only 2 ducks I'm aware of. Yes, Jordan?
Super quickly, there's a documentary on Baggio on, I think it's Netflix. Okay. It's awful. I was such I was so upset by it.
How much of it is wooden duck based?
I didn't see a duck in it, to be fair.
Oh, really? Well, they missed a trick, didn't they? On the subject of merchandise, we are releasing some Football Weekly merchandise. Many people got in touch. James says, I'd definitely buy a T-shirt of David Squire's drawing of Barry and his Super Soaker, maybe a Mark Langdon cookbook. Colin says, a Carabao Cup-style box that when it opens, it tells all your favourite pod anecdotes, such as Trevor Nelson's microwave and Ethan Pinnock's goal of the season. Mark says, I'd like a T-shirt, Barry's face on one side, oh, I'm fucking fine on the other, with reference to the final penalty in the penalty shootout in the Euros final. David Collery writes us an email. Greetings, Max, Barry and co. Regarding merchandise ideas, I'd like a Football Weekly T-shirt. Should be complete with Philippe's face on the front and Barry's on the back. I'd like a quote on each side. On the front, an Eau Claire quote about something serious and Guardian-esque, NFTs, the Qatar World Cup, or moral dilemmas regarding football. On the back, it would be Baz's anecdote about the German trade incident told verbatim, he says. If it's something you can sort out, please, Max, maybe add your face as a sleeve sponsor if you feel you're missing out. I'll have 10 and I know they would fly off the shelves. So on a serious point, thank you so much for the pod. I'm really struggling with my mental health at the moment. I feel at rock bottom, but checking in with you guys and girls thrice a week is a rare bright point for me. You never know the impact you have from afar. So a huge thank you. Take care, and take care to you, David. David in Bolden Collery. I don't think his name is David Collery. There we go. But anyway, David, appreciate that. Brian says, my name is Brian. obviously. I'm a long-time listener from Portland, Oregon in the United States. I've been listening since way back in 2010. When I remember the Potters waxing lyrical about Shabalala's opening goal at the South Africa World Cup, I'd pay good money for a t-shirt that has an image of Barney's face, Barry's face, and the words Witch's Curse underneath. If the faces were cartoon illustrations by David Squires, that would be better. Al says, I'd definitely buy a tea towel with a David Squires comic strip on it. No offence, but I'd buy anything with Barry's face on it. Anything, he says. This says, hi, Max. That's from Liam. Congratulations on the birth of baby Ian Rushton. Your discussion of Dean Marnie graffiti reminded me of two of my favourites. The first is Ricardo Fuller scratched into the toilet door of the Frog and Frigate in Southampton, which pleased me greatly as a Stoke City fan. And perhaps more absurdly, the name Phil Babb painted in 1 foot capital letters on the side of Vodka Revs in Newcastle under Lyme, Staffordshire. It's been there for as long as I can remember, and I'm in my 30s. The passage behind the pub to the high street is commonly known as Phil Babb Alley. Photos attached for your enjoyment. All the best. Well, thank you very much. And I will tweet those out as well. That is pretty much it for today's podcast. If you're looking for something else to listen to after this nonsense, can I recommend the all-new Politics Weekly UK from one of our very good sister podcasts here at The Guardian? Political columnist John Harris hosts a cast of voices from up and down the country as well as across the political spectrum to analyse the week's political news. You can get it from wherever you get your podcasts. But for the time being from us, thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday. Our producer is Joel Grove and Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Max Sarnason, and we'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.